This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, a rifle pointed at President Kennedy's motorcade. It happened in Springfield a year before his assassination. What do we know about the incident?
As the motorcade passed by that building, once it left, an Illinois Department of Public Safety employee saw a rifle and a scope sticking out the window.
Also ahead, Illinois is about to celebrate 200 years as a state. We find out the political shenanigans that have come to define Illinois were there from the start. We'll talk with a group helping prevent homelessness among veterans.
When you're serving, you're all one. The society is totally integrated. But then you come back home to a society, fairness is not treated across the board, and that's when the cracks occur.
We also have a profile of a legendary pro wrestler. That and more ahead this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Ahead on this week's show, we'll find out what it means when a school district is deactivated. Also, a college student and his mother discuss her battle with cancer and lessons learned. And Illinois became a state 200 years ago. It was a major undertaking to get to statehood. Maybe not surprising, some deception helped make it happen. That's all later this hour on Statewide. President John F. Kennedy, a motorcade, a rifle seen from a building above. It's not Dallas, 1963. We're talking Springfield a year earlier. JFK made a visit to the Illinois capital city, and for the most part it went off as planned. But new information has recently come to light about an incident involving two young men and a rifle. What happened back then? We turn to reporter Crystal Thomas with the Springfield newspaper, the State Journal Register, whose article ran this week. Crystal, thanks for being with us, and let's start by explaining Kennedy's visit to Springfield. What was his agenda here?
Well, so Kennedy was visiting Springfield as a part of a stop during a campaign tour. The midterms were in a month, and he was in Springfield to stump for Democratic candidates, namely Representative Sidney Yates. He was here to give a rousing speech to a crowd of thousands of people in Springfield, urging them to vote for his candidates.
So he comes to Springfield, and a motorcade ensues once he leaves the plane at the airport. How did this come to your attention? How did you find out that there was something that occurred during that motorcade?
Well, so on the 55th anniversary of President John F. Kennedy's actual assassination, which was last week, the Washington Post ran an article by Professor Stephen Knott. This professor actually got these declassified documents from the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston that explain this incident. He was the one who found that this incident actually happened. We didn't know about it for so many years because it was sitting in that document that was still classified until 2 years ago.
And your newspaper at the time just had a brief blurb that something had occurred.
Well, I wouldn't even call it a blurb because it was two lines on page 7. It wasn't even part of the main story. It was part of a story called Kennedy Sidelights that was explaining kind of the police presence it took to protect President Kennedy and to secure the motorcade. And the two lines didn't talk about how there was a rifle pointing at President Kennedy at one point in the motorcade. All it said was that two youths were arrested and that they were held for Secret Service. There was no follow-up and no explanation for why they were arrested.
So talk about this rifle itself, and somebody, of course, witnessed this. Do we know who saw it, and what did they say? What did they describe seeing, and of course, what did the investigation turn up?
All we know about this incident so far is what was found in that biweekly report that was declassified 2 years ago. The report is about 20 pages, but the brief about the motorcade is about a paragraph. And what it says is that there were two young men. They were in a second story floor of a building somewhere downtown. And as the motorcade passed by that building, once it left, an Illinois Department of Public Safety employee saw a rifle and a scope sticking out the window. And from there on, local police went and got the two youths, arrested them, and brought them to Secret Service. They were questioned by Secret Service. They had admitted that they did stick the rifle out the window at the presidential motorcade, but their explanation for doing so was that they wanted to see if they can see the president through the scope of the rifle, so that when he came back through the motorcade 30 minutes later, they could see him better. They weren't prosecuted. They were, however, their rifle and the ammunition was seized.
We have not heard about this locally, at least, until this recent incident. So there was never any follow-up that we could tell. No information was given by the police or the Secret Service to the local media.
Not to the local media. And it's pretty curious because I couldn't find anything in any of the Illinois State Journal's pages following the incident. There's nothing about it, according to the declassification archivist at the JFK library, and any of the documents she's looked at. There also isn't a trace of it in Springfield lore, which is what I kind of find the most interesting part, because there were locals who were involved in that arrest. There were police, there were sheriff's deputies, things like that. Maybe people who are on that motorcade route that saw something, and yet somehow this incident didn't trickle down to some kind of rumor or some kind of far-fetched story that people tell their grandkids.
We're talking with Crystal Thomas, a reporter for Springfield State Journal Register, and we're talking about JFK's 1962 visit to Springfield. Some new information that's come out regarding an incident during the motorcade in which a rifle was apparently pointed at the president. When we mentioned two youths, I believe 16 and 20 years old, were taken into custody, eventually not charged with this. You were able to track down at least one of these people.
Yes, he actually still lives in the area. He was 16 at the time, but now obviously he's much older. I paid a visit to his house on Saturday because I couldn't track down a number for him, and I knocked on his door. He opened his door. His small dog came out, and we chatted for a bit. There's no way really to begin the conversation about whether you tried to assassinate a president 56 years ago, so I mostly just asked the question. Showed him the brief. He didn't really want to talk about it. So what you see in the paper is pretty much everything he told me. Story's right there in the brief. And he grabbed his mail and then closed the door.
And you did not identify him because he was never charged with any crime.
No, he was never charged. Secret Service declined prosecution. We took a look at his local criminal records to see if that gave any kind of indication one way or the other that would talk to his motivation about the incident, and it didn't. There was nothing. He's pretty clean when it came to his record, and so we just decided not to name him, although he is named in the brief.
Well, it's interesting to me, this incident, even though we can't prove that there was any intent to harm President Kennedy at the time, it sort of foreshadows the events in Dallas just a little more than a year later. And apparently, though, it did nothing to stop the president from riding in an open motorcade, or at least that we're aware of, that, whether the Secret Service started becoming more concerned because of this one incident. Were they realizing that he was at much more risk in something like an open motorcade? It just seems interesting to me, the close proximity of this to the actual assassination.
Yeah, the actual assassination was 13 months after the Springfield incident, and there are a lot of similarities. President Kennedy in Dallas was in an open-top limousine, similar to how he was in Springfield. He was shot from above. So there were a lot of similarities between the two trips. And one thing we can't know at this point was what kind of conversations the Secret Service had or President Kennedy had after this incident in Springfield. If there were any conversations, they're not in records that we can see or have been declassified. But I will say that one thing to keep in mind is that President Kennedy himself didn't enjoy bulletproof glass. He wanted to be out in the open. And one of his most infamous quotes was, you know, if I'm paraphrasing right now, but if someone wanted to kill a president, they would find a way to do so. So whether they took lessons from this Springfield incident or not, there's no way of knowing if that trigger had been pulled in Springfield, if something had more aggressive had happened in Springfield, whether that would have prevented Dallas. I'd still love to hear from people who were in Springfield during that incident. I think there are so many more stories to be told. I'm sure that there are witnesses seeing the two men either being arrested or seeing the rifle scope themselves or the Illinois Department of Public Safety employee. I think there's still a lot more to learn about this incident, and I'm hoping in the next couple of months I can find something.
That's Crystal Thomas. She's a reporter for the State Journal Register. You can find a link to her article. It's on JFK's 1962 visit to the city of Springfield and an incident involving a rifle being pointed at the president. You can read that. The link is available at our website at statewideshow.com. Crystal, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Sean.
We take a lot of things for granted, our health among them. What happens when you're faced with a health crisis, like cancer? Based on recent data, approximately 38% of men and women will be diagnosed with the disease at some point during their lifetimes. One of those who's had to battle cancer is John Haar's mother. John is an SIU Carbondale radio, TV, and digital media student. His mom, April Teske, works at the university. The two shared with us a candid discussion about her situation.
There are obstacles in life that everyone has to go through. Some are big, some are small, and some last forever, and you have to learn how to live with it. My mom was forced to go through that last obstacle when she was diagnosed with cancer. Mom, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, my name is April Teske. I'm faculty here in College of Education, and I've been here for 5 years. And before that, I was an educator. I was a special education teacher. I was the principal at an elementary middle school here in Carbondale for a little over 7 years before coming to SIU. And I have three kids.
My mom was diagnosed with cancer while she was a principal. She says that the diagnosis did not come easy for her.
I was diagnosed on February 19th, 2013. I was having a lot of problems before then, health problems for probably 6-9 months before. And it just took the doctors about 6 months and six different kinds of doctors before they actually found my cancer and diagnosed me.
She says that her type of cancer, follicular non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, is rarely diagnosed in women her age. But due to her high-stress job, she was prime breeding ground for the cancer.
One doctor explained to me that your body is built for short bursts of stress. So, you know, our bodies are built that way. We're created that way to deal with stress and anxiety, but not continuous, ongoing stress. So what happens is your body is constantly working all the time just to deal with that stress and anxiety and to bring yourself down from that, then it doesn't have the opportunity to actually do any healing of itself. And so I believe that that's probably why mine progressed as quickly as it did as young as I was.
After the diagnosis, she had to go through 6 months of chemotherapy. She was the sickest that she has ever been, yet her tactic was to act as if nothing was wrong.
No one really saw how sick I was. And when I was really sick, I didn't leave the house. I made sure you kids were at your dad's house or visiting relatives, you know, like you went to Florida for one of my treatments. People at work didn't see how sick I was. And so when I finally did go out and present myself, whether it was at work or wherever, they saw the usual April. And so I don't think anyone really understood the magnitude of what I was going through for that 6 to 8 months when I was going through chemotherapy and how sick I was. So their demands on me were the same. You know, they still expected my output to be the same, to me to work at the same levels I typically always did. So what I did then, being the type of person I am, and you're a lot like me, mm-hmm. I kept trying to work up to that level and work up to their expectation. So, you know, I think I would do that differently.
While going through this awful experience, she says that she has learned a lot of life lessons, and her view of life has even changed in some ways.
I think what it taught me is it's okay to be vulnerable, and it's okay to let people know that you have new boundaries, and it's okay to let people help you, you know, which I don't do really well, you know. So mm-hmm. I think I learned that, and it's really helped me readjust my priorities. You know, title is no longer important as it used to be. You know, the amount of money that I make is no longer that important to me. Those things just aren't important to me. And I left my job. You know, I left my job 2 months after my last treatment and came here to the university to a much less paying job, but much less stressful job. And I'm able to spend much more time with you all mm-hmm. and, you know, put you guys first and put my health first.
She says that one of the biggest changes has been her outlook on life, knowing every day that she still has cancer.
It's a constant reminder every day about truly what is important in your life, that it isn't a job and it isn't a title. You know, it isn't all these outside commitments that we make. It's about the relationships that we form. So I think I pay a lot more attention, more than I ever did, to my relationships with people.
She has been through some of the worst times of her life because of cancer, and she wishes that she didn't have it. However, she doesn't wish every part away.
I would never wish away the conversations I've been able to have as a result of my cancer, like this one, and I would not wish away the lessons that I've learned in a million years. So if I have to have cancer in order to have learned those lessons about the vulnerability of life, I can be thankful for it.
That's cancer survivor April Teske. She works at SIU Carbondale. Her son John, who you heard speaking with her, is a student on the campus. You're listening to Statewide. Deactivating a school district. We'll tell you what that means. The story coming up. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll hear how Illinois became a state. Turns out not everything was on the up and up. And Madeline Beck has a report on the jobs available in the ag industry. It's not always about being out in the fields. That's all still to come on Statewide. But up next, a Northern Illinois school district will be deactivated. It may be part of a trend that continues to affect shrinking rural school districts. Peter Medlin has more on that.
Farm fields sit comfortably around Indian Creek High School. But step into one of the classrooms inside and you'll feel a far cry from the rural stereotype. The kids are looking down at laptops, glancing up to check the flat-screen monitors mounted to the walls displaying the Quizlet program they're using to study. The only thing that isn't updated is the bell.
And it's a real bell.
Principal Sarah Montgomery jokes.
It's not digital.
Despite their tech upgrades and modern setups, like virtually everywhere else in rural Illinois, their enrollments are steadily slipping. They're down 90 high school students from 10 years ago, now hovering around 200. But next year, they'll be getting more than 50 new students. They're coming from nearby Pawpaw, where voters have decided to deactivate the town's high school in the face of those same enrollment troubles and state funding challenges. Pawpaw will now be one of just 8 deactivated school districts in Illinois. It's a town of just over 800 people, and the measure only passed by around 60 votes. Stan Adcock is the superintendent of Pawpaw Schools.
The whole process has been very difficult, and it's been heart-wrenching for everybody involved.
Michelle Henninger is a principal consultant at the Illinois State Board of Education.
What we've seen, the districts that have deactivated in the past have leaned more towards smaller districts. So they're usually a smaller district that maybe only have one facility.
The deactivation process has taken around a year for the two districts.
The board has been looking at being able to do something for longer than that because we've known for a long time that we need to be able to offer our students more than what we could offer them here at Pawpaw.
Adcock says their board has been considering many options, including deactivation or consolidation with one of the other local schools.
Right now we're offering students the basic education, but we aren't able to get into those things that we'd like to as far as the extras.
Their partnership with Indian Creek started small with those extras. First it was for sports, Then they started talking about educational partnerships. Some Pawpaw students started coming over to take foreign language classes, and it eventually led to the deactivation plans. Indian Creek Principal Sarah Montgomery says the idea is starting to grow on their students.
I think our kids are excited. You know, at first they were a little bit apprehensive when they saw that the talks were starting, but then once with the co-op of the sports, they know the students. We had homecoming together this year, and the kids really had a lot of fun. So I think the kids are excited about it.
And since Election Day, the plans have marched on. Indian Creek's guidance counselor has started driving the 15 miles to Pawpaw to meet with their students. The agreement is also allowing one teacher to come over. And Pawpaw says they're doing everything they can to keep the teachers left behind on hand in any way they can. Starting next fall, the deactivation is already going to be paying dividends for both sides. Pawpaw students get access to more classes and resources, and Indian Creek gets more students to help them expand.
I think the first thing that we'll notice going into next year is we'll be able to offer back again Spanish 4.
Back at Pawpaw, they're going to have to figure out what to do with the empty space where the high school classes used to be. They're thinking about possibly hosting educational events or some sort of alternative schools. Aside from that, they're going to focus on the K-8 students they still have. They're also hoping to modernize and introduce more STEM classes and technology, and they're adamant that they do not want to lose their whole district. But because of the population and demographic shifts in rural Illinois, Pawpaw's Superintendent Stan Adcock says that he wouldn't be surprised if deactivation became more and more the norm in the future.
So I think it's going to become a trend, unfortunately, due to state funding and enrollment. There are just a lot of issues, but I see this basically as something that'll happen a lot more.
The deactivation is only a 2-year agreement, which means that it may not be permanent. But that doesn't necessarily mean the high school will come back, even though it's possible a deactivated district has never been reactivated in Illinois. I'm Peter Medlin.
Illinois' 200th birthday is this coming Monday, December 3rd. Illinois is a major state with the 6th largest population. But Tara McClellan McAndrews says there was a time when statehood was far from certain, and for this week's Illinois Issues, she reports on how that all changed with a bit of deception. I had a chance to talk with her. Tara, let's go back 200 years. I doubt most people today can comprehend that there would even be a doubt as to whether Illinois would be ready to be a state, but it was a much different place than what we know today.
It was a much different place. A little bit more than 200 years ago, we were a territory. We weren't a state, of course. And frankly, we were a bit of a backland. We were the Wild West. Illinois really became a state when it did because of one young, ambitious man named Daniel Pope Cook. He went to D.C. to seek a patronage job and was unsuccessful. And when he came back, kind of all of a sudden, he decides we need to be a state. Well, being a state means that there will be more opportunity for everyone, presumably him included. I talked with state historian Sam Wheeler about Daniel Pope Cook's role in all of this.
He buys an interest in the first newspaper printed in the Illinois Territory, and that newspaper becomes his pulpit for advocating for statehood. And I also love this argument that Cook proposes in his newspaper. He says the Illinois Territory is destined for statehood, so why delay the inevitable?
So you focus on Daniel Cook. You also focus on Nathaniel Pope, a relative of his.
Daniel was Nathaniel's nephew. Nathaniel Pope was the Illinois Territory congressional rep who could not vote at that time because we were a territory. And Nathaniel Pope, as one historian told me, basically kind of gets this letter in the mail saying, hey, we decided we want to become a state, and so he just takes it under his wing, makes that his cause, and does some things in the process that work greatly to our advantage as a future state, and they get the job done, and they get it done pretty darn fast.
Well, slavery was still an issue in Illinois. A lot of people don't think of Illinois as a slave state, but back at that time, there were slaves living in Illinois.
Absolutely. And it was legal. And one of the problems in our territory becoming a state was that the law that ruled admission to the Union as a state, the Northwest Ordinance, forbid slavery. So what we had to do was tread a very fine line. We wanted to keep the settlers here, many who came from the South and had brought their slaves and were pro-slavery. We wanted to keep them here. We wanted to get more people here. How do we do that? How do we appease those folks and still toe the line with Northwest Ordinance, which forbids slavery. And we did that by framing our first state's constitution, which basically enabled both. The new state's constitution basically said, we will not allow future slavery, but the existing slaves can stay. It was a bit of wordplay, if you will, that opened the door for what became slavery in Illinois by another name, indentured servitude.
So Illinois becomes a state in 1818. About 40 years later, Abraham Lincoln is elected president, and you wrote that the way that the state's northern boundary was configured really helped ensure that Lincoln did win the presidency. Otherwise, he may never have risen to that level.
That is according to one man I interviewed, Frank Cicero Jr., who just wrote a book about this. And he looked at the vote totals that the Republican Party garnered up in the northern part of Illinois. Our boundaries were extended by our territorial congressional rep, Nathaniel Pope, before we became a state. When he applied to Congress and said, hey, we want to be a state, he also said the boundary should include the bottom half of Lake Michigan, so we would have access to what became Chicago. It wasn't at the time, of course. This opened up, as we now know, an enormous land for a lot of population, future population. And Frank Cicero Jr. has looked at the votes and the research and has said, if that boundary had not been extended by Nathaniel Pope, we may never have had Abraham Lincoln as our president.
Circling back to the decision to seek statehood in 1818, is it safe to say that the state then jumped the gun on this?
I think it is. Yeah, I do. First of all, there was no real call from the residents for us to gain statehood. And we didn't have the population. It's very clear. It's a pretty funny story, really, about how we frankly lied. We cooked the books. We were supposed to have 60,000 people. We didn't have near that. But we had to prove to Congress that we had 40,000. Frankly, we didn't have that. So one of the historians I interviewed was Illinois State Archives Director Dave Jones. He explains very well about how we handled that problem.
Nathaniel Pope, what he did, which was brilliant, was when you conduct a census, it's the federal government that conducts a census. He slipped into the bill that, hey, don't worry about it. Illinois will do the census for you. You guys are busy there in Washington. You don't want to take the time. We'll conduct the census. And the federal government bought it.
In many ways, we weren't ready, but we made it work, right? The Illinois way, we made it work.
But had they waited, and you talked about some of the decisions made with the state's boundaries, is it safe to say had they waited too long, we might be a much smaller state today and a less powerful state?
You could probably make that argument. It's hard to say how long we would have had to wait to be less powerful, but certainly by starting this process as early as we did, we were in a position to grab land that ended up helping us enormously become a powerful state. And in retrospect, while it was premature, it served us very, very well.
That's Tara McClellan McAndrew. She wrote about the way Illinois became a state back in 1818. We also talked for a moment about Illinois' first state house, which is now long gone.
One of the other problems with when we became a state was, where are we going to meet? We had no capital. So our lawmakers kept meeting at the territorial capital, which is Kaskaskia. And one little bit of trivia that I think is interesting. The first state house we ever had in Kaskaskia is completely gone. It is either in the Mississippi River or it's in the Gulf of Mexico. It was washed away by floods in Kaskaskia, so we can't see it. It is no more.
That first state house at Kaskaskia is long gone, but you can see a photo of it. We have a link to that at our website, statewideshow.com. Yeah. agriculture is changing, so is the meaning of an agriculture degree. Growing and harvesting food is still a decent chunk of the industry, but Madeline Beck found out there are seemingly infinite ag careers in fields like food processing, sales, and technology. She has this report.
This may sound like the average industrial space, but it's not. It's a greenhouse at a research farm outside Ames, Iowa. There, bright green conveyor belts loop down into trays of wastewater. It smells like wet dog. It's a testing ground for Gross One Technologies, which grows algae on the belts to eat up nitrogen and phosphorus out of wastewater, stuff that in high amounts is harmful to most fish. Usually, wastewater is treated with chemicals or bacteria, but that creates a sludgy mess that people pay to get rid of. Martin Gross is president and co-founder of the company and says his way is better and cheaper.
If you use algae to treat wastewater, you create algae biomass, and that algae biomass can be sold and made into a variety of products.
Like green, goose poop-looking fertilizer, which is what they're doing. Gross One's process is being used in Chicago and a few towns in Iowa, but it all started with Gross's research at Iowa State University. There, he got a lot of ag-affiliated degrees, including a PhD in agriculture and biosystems engineering. And Gross is just one example of what people can do with an ag degree these days. Mike Gall works in career services at ISU's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences.
Well, this past May, we had 106 ag biz students graduate. 97 of those kids walked across the stage with a job in hand, which is just unbelievable statistics.
Gall says only about 8% of students getting a degree from the college go on to farm. Instead of raising livestock, some end up trading stock or lending money to farmers. Many others study animal sciences to become vets, but he says some majors don't have enough students to meet demand, like in food science.
The bottom line is this, we all have to eat, right?
And he says they need more people studying horticulture, you know, landscaping and golf course grooming. For major ag universities like Purdue, University of Illinois, and Iowa State University, most ag degrees have placement rates in the 80 or 90 percentile. That is, a vast majority either find a job right after college or further their education. And that's a big deal when the traditional farming economy isn't doing so great. Kevin Kimley is also at Iowa State, directing its Agriculture Entrepreneurship Initiative. He's a former ag entrepreneur himself and says there's major opportunities there, too.
Yeah, it's a hot market.
Some ag entrepreneurs are like star ISU grad Colin Hurd, who's making headway in the autonomous tractor industry through his company, SmartAg. But Kimley crunched the numbers a few years ago, and at that time, most ag entrepreneurs were actually food truck owners. The college degrees themselves are changing because companies need people who know agriculture and business, finance, and technology. To meet some of those demands, the University of Illinois is offering a brand new degree that combines computer science and crop science. There are just 3 students going for it so far, and Omkar Manoj Haridas is one of them. He came from Bangalore, India, where he once had to choose between studying computer science and biology.
So in the end, I decided on choosing computer science, but that was a really hard decision, and I'm still interested in biology.
Biology runs in the family, as his mom is a doctor, but...
I mean, the sight of blood scares me a lot, so that was out of the picture for me.
But with the degree he's now pursuing, he wants to use ag data to create better seeds. And the massive amounts of big ag data will take a certain level of expertise to sift through and understand, according to Adam Davis. He heads the Department of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois. He says companies are already interested in hiring students with a new degree. But he stresses that ag degrees like this are for people who want to improve our food system overall.
It's a perfect major for smart kids who are idealistic and want to do something for society and to help make the world a better place.
So from cleaning wastewater with algae to using data from big ag companies, there are plenty of non-farming options for those with an ag degree. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
Remember to follow us each week on Statewide. You can do that by going to our Facebook page or Twitter. Just look for Statewide Show. You can also find our website, statewideshow.com. It has all the episodes. Stay with us. A profile of a pro wrestling legend. That's on the way on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We'll hear about a group in Illinois helping veterans with things like finances. We learn how that can prevent vets from becoming homeless. But first, professional wrestling has a long and colorful history in the Midwest. For many of those years, Harley Race was a top draw in the ring. Today, the 75-year-old remains a player in the industry. He has a wrestling school in Missouri. Wayne Pratt went there to give us an update on the king, Harley Race.
Before this guy,
if you smell what the Rock is cooking!
And around the same time as this guy,
my name's Ric Flair, and I'm gonna burst that bubble, big man!
There was another headliner at professional wrestling events around the world.
Harley Leland Race.
Missouri native Handsome Harley, as he's been called over the years, wrestled in big centers like New York and Los Angeles, and almost everywhere else.
Couldn't get into Russia and couldn't get into quite a few places like that, but been in damn near to all the others.
Do you miss that?
Why, sure I do. If I could back myself up 30 years, I would be the happiest man on the face of the earth.
Today, the 8-time world champion is still in the game. He's guiding the younger generation at the Harley Race Wrestling Academy, about an hour west of St. Louis in Troy.
That gives me something to do other than just to sit there in the house and wait on myself to die.
At 75 years old, he still has a sense of humor. At least I think he was joking. His face can still look menacing, but Race is dealing with several health issues. That includes breaking both legs in a fall at his home more than a year ago. The Pro Wrestling Hall of Famer uses a motorized scooter to get around the two rinks set up at the academy, and with a cigarette usually hanging out of his mouth, he watches the youngsters like a hawk as they go through the paces. One of the people bouncing off the ropes is 22-year-old Sean Patrick Phillips from Whiteside in Lincoln County. He has a clear understanding that his road to the big time and people like World Wrestling Entertainment owner Vince McMahon goes through Handsome Harley.
He's the kind of guy that can make that phone call to Vince, you know. So as far as like in the wrestling business goes, Harley Race's name pulls all the way around here.
The outcome of pro wrestling matches is usually scripted, but the training is intense. About 10 hopefuls are matching up with each other on this warm day at the academy. A big garage door is open in an attempt to cool down the building, where Moses Josiah Powell has been training for about 4 months.
The toughest thing so far is just physically, you know, it hurts. It doesn't feel good, but just getting past that, that's the tough part.
And have you got past that yet?
No, I don't think I ever will.
Despite those aches and pains, Powell tries to soak in all the advice Race has to offer.
You know it's coming for somebody who knows what he's talking about. So, like, whenever he speaks, my ears are clearly open. And I'm ready to take any criticism or any, you know, tips that he has to give me.
Back in his office, where mementos of his legendary career hang on the walls, including the proclamation making September 20th, 1997, Handsome Harley Race Day in St. Louis County, Race lights up another cigarette and reflects on how it's all come, as they would say in the wrestling world, full squared circle.
When you sit here and you think about where you've been in the art of wrestling, there's nothing but pleasure and happiness that starts to come out of you. And thank God for that.
I'm Wayne Pratt.
If you grew up during Harley Race's heyday in the ring, you might have seen him performing in St. Louis. He often appeared on the program Wrestling at the Chase, where bouts were held at the Chase Park Plaza Hotel. The hugely popular show ran for 24 years on KPLR-TV in St. Louis and was broadcast into many parts of Illinois. This past week, Larry Matisik, the longtime promoter and ring announcer for that show, passed away following an illness. He is remembered for calling the chaos that was always taking place.
I don't care how tough Race is, I don't think even he can hang on under the stress of the Iron Claw that long. Race grabbing the referee, and Race! Oh, Race slamming the referee, Charles Van Ader, into David Von Erich.
Mattisick helped make St. Louis into a mecca for pro wrestling. He authored books on the subject and helped establish the St. Louis Wrestling Hall of Fame. He was also an inductee into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. Larry Mattisick was 72 years old. Next, we introduce you to an organization working to reduce homelessness among veterans. It's called Operation Support Our Troops. It's based in suburban Lyle. Leon Mangum coordinates a program that helps veterans who face financial trouble. Sue Liston is the administrative director, and Brian O'Keefe visited with both of them in their warehouse while volunteers packed care packages and Christmas stockings for veterans.
Is there something unique about homelessness among veterans?
The uniqueness among them is, I would say, some mental health issues that's actually recognized, as opposed to the general populace that may be homelessness, that may be in homelessness that that is not recognized. They may not receive the assistance that a veteran would receive, and with the reception of that assistance for the veteran is the recognition of homelessness. So counseling is put in place for them. Also the opportunity to learn a little more about the benefits and how to use them that's been afforded to them, or even just take the opportunity to see if they're even eligible.
Yeah, it strikes me as so tragic because my impression, maybe I'm wrong, but there are so many services available for veterans to help them if they have mental health issues or if they're having homelessness issues or financial issues. How big are the cracks that these vets are falling through?
I think the cracks are huge. In particular, when you're serving, you're all one. The society is totally integrated. But then you come back home to a society that still have percentages that are not integrated and fairness is not treated across the board, then that's when the cracks occur. You have to think about it. Vietnam veterans are the sons and daughters of those World War II and Korean War veterans that came home. And when those veterans came home, benefits were not distributed equally amongst the different groups, the ethnic backgrounds. It was still segregation, or it was right at the end of segregation during that time. And none of these type of services even were available prior to Vietnam. So we have to thank the Vietnam veterans for their service, because of it, these community-based organizations have come to light to assist the veterans and educate them on the benefits that they were not privy to during those times. So those cracks still exist. I mean, those people still walk amongst us.
So you work with a lot of active duty as well.
Yes.
And I wonder, are there challenges that are unique to what I will call current veterans, more recent veterans, people who have just served and are trying to reintegrate? Are there unique challenges to serving them?
I'm not sure if there's unique challenges, but they are very proud, and they've served their country selflessly. And for them to ask for help, it's very hard for them to come and say, I really need help. It's hard for them to come to say that this is what they need, and this is, you know, and to take to them, it's a handout. You know, we don't look at it as a handout. We look at it as a hand up. But, you know, it's hard for them to get through that.
And I would imagine, and I realize I'm painting with a very broad brush here, but they're younger. So reaching a younger group of veterans may be more difficult than reaching a 40, 50-year-old veteran.
If that is the case, it's probably because of life experience. They're younger, so they have less years on this earth than older veteran that just come out, like myself. I'm recently out of the military, 2015. So I know that group that's coming out right now, and just as Sue said, pride gets in the way, in particular because we tend to recognize that we may have made some bad decisions along the way. with finances, or probably didn't save properly, or you had some really tough experiences during your deployments where you come home and the family's gone, the family's broken, or you don't know how to reach out to your family anymore because of experiences that you've had during your deployments in theater. Those things create some really, really large pitfalls, and it's hard to get out of them. And unless you've been through it, it's really tough to understand and feel what that veteran is going through to help them along the way.
Yeah, I don't pretend to understand it. It's not part of my experience.
Right.
If I acknowledge to you that I'm not going to even pretend to understand, what is it that you want me to do then? If we agree that I'm probably not going to be able to understand it because I haven't lived it, what do veterans like you need from civilians like me?
An active ear, one that really takes the information in and allow it to manifest some true understanding, because it's one thing to sit here and just listen to conversation, yeah, and you get that quite a bit. You get the yeah, and you wonder, wow, are they really listening? And that makes me shut down. I don't want to give you any more because I'm giving you information that you consider to be senseless, because it's a yeah response while I'm trying to speak to you. But if I give the information, I'd like for you to reach out by reaching out to organizations or individuals that could possibly help me. Can you guide me along the way? Have you heard of any information that I may not have heard of? Do you know of anyone that I may not know of that you can connect me with? Do you have any veterans in your family? Do you have friends that are veterans that you can connect me with that would sit down and be able to communicate it to you effectively because they have a close relationship with you? Like, if you have that in your inner circle, bring that to me. Allow me to become part of that. Somehow connect. It's connections.
Mm-hmm. So you guys also do operations support our troops. You are supporting people who are currently serving. Give me the Cliff's Notes version. What is Operation Support Our Troops?
We started in 2003 sending care packages, and we are still sending about 200 care packages a month, or sometimes even more. And the box is meant to be shared, so it's a good-sized box. It's 12 by 12. You know, that's the care package program, and we're coming up on our 2 millionth pound. So that's going to be a big milestone for us, and we're looking forward to it. And then we also have our Leap of Faith program for Families of the Fallen, which is a three-day seminar for families that have lost someone in the military. And we do that 2 to 3 times a year.
It's interesting when I start thinking about the service that you're providing for active duty, or people who are currently deployed. And I wonder how important it is for you to make a connection with them now while they're active duty, so that when they are veterans, you've already got a connection.
Yes, and their families. Most of our volunteers have a connection with the military. They have someone serving, have had someone serving, served themselves. So we are a military family here at Operation Support Our Troops.
Leon, you look like when I was asking that question, like you had something to add about making those connections now.
Oh, yeah, it's important that we get into the active duty ranks and to give information to service members so that they know once they take that uniform off, there are organizations that they can go to, that we are here. So making the connection now by creating partnerships with the branches of service under DOD and the current commanders and programs such as the Soldier for Life program, the Marine for Life program, TAP, is really important. Service members come out not even knowing that these community bases exist until they are in trouble. And we want to try and reach them to prevent them from slipping into any trouble. So if you foresee that, you know you can reach out to Operation Support Our Troops America and others. And if it's something that we can't provide directly, we can definitely connect you to organizations that will. It's about seeing the mission through to the very end.
That's Leon Mangum and also Sue Liston. They're with Operation Support Our Troops, based in Lisle. And they talk with Brian O'Keefe here on Statewide. do it for the show this week. This episode and past shows can be found at statewideshow.com. That's also where you can weigh in on our program. Let us know what you think. We'd like to hear from you. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.